This Janet Mefford Today podcast is brought to you by Preborn. For $140, you can provide ultrasounds to 5 women in crisis pregnancies. Call now, 855-402-BABY. That's 855-402-2229 or janetmefford.com.
This is Janet Mefford Today.
Our confidence is in Christ alone.
Are we going to stand with God, come what may?
If the Word of God says it, I believe it.
And that's the way it is.
And now, here is Janet Mefford.
Welcome, everybody. Great to have you with us again. It is very interesting to me. I have pointed this out at various junctures for the last several months as the campaign begins to heat up a little bit on the Democratic side of the aisle. And we have seen people like Mayor Pete Buttigieg, who has a quote unquote husband. He doesn't, of course. He has another man in a Justice Kennedy created marriage, which is not really a marriage. We all know that. But he's been all on the rampage since day one when he introduced himself as a potential for the ticket in 2020 on the Democratic ticket. And he's talked all about how Mike Pence is terrible, the vice president of the United States. And he has a Christianity that is just not loving. It's not welcoming. It doesn't care about the poor. It doesn't care about women. It doesn't care about gays. It doesn't care about immigrants. It doesn't care. This is just the mantra of the left. And what they love to do in the news is consistently try to boost this idea that there is this burgeoning progressive left that is just bursting at the seams and exploding all over the place. And people are rejecting that old fashioned Christianity that's so full of hate and bigotry. And Mayor Pete will be a new face on Christianity, except people aren't buying it. What were the numbers I just saw? Something like he has 4% of the Democratic support. It's not going to get you much of anywhere unless somebody puts you on the ticket as kind of a mercy move. Like, let's give this boy a boost. He's a mayor from South Bend, Indiana, but he does have some really good street cred as far as identity politics. So let's put him on the ticket and show how progressive we are. Still could happen. We'll see. But at any rate, one of the progressive leftists who has been around for quite a while and said something particularly insane recently is the prominent religious left activist William Barber. You might be familiar with William Barber. He had the Moral Mondays initiative, and he was all on the rampage in North Carolina, protesting all sorts of conservative policies. He also loves Planned Parenthood. So just keep that in mind. I want to play for you some of the speech that he gave as a speaker at the Democratic National Committee summer meeting on Friday. I don't even know how to respond to this in advance. I think you just have to listen to it for yourself. Listen to cut one.
When we embrace moral language, we must ask, does our policy care for the least of these? Does it lift up those who are most marginalized and dejected in our society? Does it establish justice? That is the moral question. If someone calls it socialism, then we must compel them to acknowledge that the Bible must then promote socialism. Because Jesus offered free health care to everyone, and he never charged a leper a copay.
Wow. He really is doing violence to the Word of God, isn't he? Let's talk about this just for a moment, particularly that last portion where he said that Jesus never charged a leper a copay. Is William Barber actually trying to imply or infer or say straight out that the Lord was a doctor? He is the great physician, but he's God. And is he trying to imply that as a physician, small p, the Lord worked in some kind of county hospital under a national health service in which all of the copays and all of the costs of medical treatment were covered by the rest of the citizens who had money ripped away from them and put into a socialist system whereby everybody would get medical care for free, even though nothing about it was free. And Jesus was operating in some sort of Canadian socialist healthcare nirvana. And that's why every leper who came into the hospital, Jesus healed that leper for free. What is he talking about? First of all, Jesus didn't even heal everybody who needed healing. That wasn't why Jesus healed. Let's just go over this very, very briefly. The reason that the Son of God healed, the reason that he performed miracles, was to establish and show people that these were signs of the coming of the kingdom of God, that God had promised for so long that the Messiah would come. and that you would know him and you would know that God had sent him. And he was confirming that by going around and doing miracles like changing water into wine and healing many people. But his job was not to go around and heal people for free without copays. That kind of stuff, that kind of talk is just offensive because he's taking the Bible and trying to squeeze it into his progressive political mold to make a point in order to score points. And he just ends up twisting scripture, and it's so irritating. Now let's go to the next cut. This is cut two.
You want to have, it's time for us to say, if you want to have a moral debate, bring it on, baby. The Bible says that the nation will be judged by how it treats the poor and the sick and women and the immigrant. The Bible says that God makes it rain on the just and the unjust alike. If you want to call caring for folk socialism, then the Constitution is a socialist document because it calls us to promote the general welfare and to establish justice.
That's just ridiculous. How in the world do people listen to this guy? The Constitution is a socialist document. Anybody with any knowledge whatsoever of socialism and any knowledge whatsoever of American civics knows that nothing could be further from the truth. We have an order in a society that is built upon the foundation of God's word. We believe in private property. We believe in individual liberty, individual freedom. We believe in a government of the people, by the people, for the people. We believe in representative government and a constitutional republic. And we have based everything on the foundation of God-given rights, the rights that were given to us by the Lord, not by government. And therefore, the government does not have the right to take any of those rights that were given to us by God away from us. Is it so hard to understand what American principles are such that you would stand up and say something so incredibly ignorant? It's not ignorance. I don't believe it's ignorance. I believe what he is doing is just trying to push us all to the left, because that's what progressives do. But let's just talk about this for a minute, because he said, if we want to have a moral debate, bring it on, baby. All right, I'm going to bring it on, William Barber. Let's go back to a story from late May of 2019. This is via Juicy Ecumenism, in which they report that William Barber recently expanded the scope of his political advocacy by opposing an Alabama law that prohibits most abortions. The legislation is expected at the time to undergo a series of court challenges that could end up at the Supreme Court. Barber's Moral Mondays initiative first gained traction in North Carolina by protesting conservative policies instituted by the state legislature, including funding reductions for state programs. The initiative served as a template for Barber's creation of Moral Witness Wednesdays. Boy, he could take every day of the week and just do a Moral Thursday and a Moral Friday. These initiatives are part of Barber's larger organization called Repairers of the Breach. It's all about claiming a moral obligation to support an expansive taxpayer-funded welfare state. Just like the Bible teaches, right? No, not at all. It portrays itself as based upon a framework of moral and constitutional values rooted in religiously progressive initiatives, such as how society treats women, the LGBTQ community, the poor, immigrants, children, workers, and people of color. It's all intersectional garbage. Barber aimed his past advocacy efforts in support of anti-poverty initiatives. Now he's equating a biblical responsibility to care for the poor with voting for candidates who espouse a big government welfare state. He spoke at this rally in protest of the Alabama abortion ban, criticized the Alabama officials as pro-life on the issue of abortion, but not pro-life when it came to wages or increasing funding for food stamps. Right, because slaughtering the unborn and cutting back on a welfare system of food stamps is exactly the same. Because by not giving people more food stamps, you're slaughtering them and taking their lives away. This is progressivism at its most hypocritical, I would say. And by the way, this is the same man who received an award from Planned Parenthood. Did you know that? He works with Planned Parenthood. It's all about abortion on demand. Meanwhile, you look at the numbers of the African-American community and the abortion rates in the African-American community. As Juicy Ecumenism points out, African-Americans have an abortion rate four times higher than whites and Hispanics. Abortion has taken the lives of more Black Americans than every other cause of death since Roe v. Wade passed in 1973. And by the way, Planned Parenthood, as we all know, has its roots in the racist practice of eugenics. works. Boy, William Barber, if you're going to talk about a moral debate, and you're going to talk about what is best for your own people, why don't you talk about that? Why don't you talk about the extermination of your community and stand up against the extermination of your community? Instead, you take an award from the very people who are taking the blood money and trafficking in the body parts of said babies. I think if you're to that point, you have jettisoned any credibility that you have for speaking on anything that you tout as moral. Just the way I see it. We're going to come back. Stay with us. Are you among the millions of Americans who feel uncertain when it comes to your health care? As a Christian, are you looking for health care that doesn't violate your morals and convictions? Well, we're happy to inform you that there is a solution, and that solution is Liberty HealthShare. Liberty HealthShare is a community of like-minded Christians who work together to pay for their medical costs. It allows you to decide how, when, and where you will access health care so you can make the best choice for you and your family. Starting at $199 a month for a single, up to $529 a month for a family. That's mom, dad, and all the kids. This is how healthcare should be. For more information, call 855-585-4237 or visit lightyourliberty.com. That's lightyourliberty.com and regain control over your healthcare costs. 855-585-4237 or lightyourliberty.com. Together, we're changing healthcare for good.
From Affirm Films, Provident Films, and the Kindred Brothers comes Overcomer. John Harrison is a frustrated coach questioning his value until he crosses paths with a student struggling on her own journey.
What have you allowed to define you? When you find your identity in the one who created you, it'll change your whole perspective. You
Overcomer, starring Alex Kendrick and Priscilla Shirer. Rated PG. Parental guidance suggested. Now play. More information is available at overcomermovie.com.
If you're a medical professional, here's a way to move from success to even greater significance. Mercy Ships has an urgent need for pediatric registered nurses. You'll be joining dozens of volunteer medical professionals who've been blessed by the opportunity.
I think all nurses should do something like this. To serve the unserved is one of the most beautiful experiences.
Get more information by visiting mercyships.org/nurses. Mercy Ships, bringing hope and healing to the world's forgotten poor.
Back on Janet Mefford today. Well, this is an interesting story. The Young Americas Foundation has just released a poll that reveals how the upcoming generation is not always buying into the lies of the left about socialism, freedom, and free markets. We're going to find out more about it now from Spencer Brown, spokesman for the Young Americas Foundation. Spencer, thanks a lot for being with us. How are you?
Hey, I'm doing great. Thank you for having me.
Well, it's great to talk to you. You guys have just released the results of this poll surveying 13 to 22-year-olds. Tell us a little bit about what you were trying to find out here and what the whole poll is about.
Yeah, so at Young Americas Foundation, you know, we work with young people and students every day. And we've seen a lot of people on the left claiming that this rising generation, Generation Z, as they're calling it, is just completely in love with and has bought into socialism entirely. And that's something that we just didn't buy. So we decided we wanted to get some hard numbers on it. So we commissioned this poll. We teamed up with Echelon Insights to conduct this. It was nationwide, more than 2,000 people in that age range, you said 13 to 22, to see how they really felt. And what we saw was interesting, because while they're definitely being influenced by the left, whether it be in education or the media or pop culture, they're definitely not buying into it completely.
Well, that's good. To what extent are they buying into it? What are the numbers in terms of what they're buying into versus, you know, freedom versus socialism, free markets versus socialism? What did you find out?
Well, yeah, that's what's really interesting to us, is it seems like Generation Z is just kind of confused right now, because while they find things like small business and entrepreneurship and free enterprise to be very favorable, they also, by a margin of 35%, felt that socialism as an ideology was favorable. And so there's clearly a disconnect there between what they like and appreciate about America, you know, all the freedom and the free market and all the opportunity that gives them, but still, you know, feeling like this buzzword of socialism is something that they should be liking. And so that's why, you know, it shows that there's an opportunity there for groups like Young America's Foundation and for parents and families to still, you know, talk to their students or their children And tell them, you know, socialism is not what you're being told that it is, because if you truly adopt and embrace socialism, you're going to lose out on all the stuff that you love about America.
Well, yeah, what's so interesting to me is you guys found out, as I understand it, that a majority of these young people who were polled actually don't know what socialism is, and they can't define free enterprise either. So do they even know what they're saying? Yeah.
Yeah, that's exactly right. They don't, it's unfortunate to say it, but they really just don't know what they're talking about. But again, that's where this opportunity comes in to educate them and to, you know, tell them the truth about socialism and what a true socialist system in the United States would look like and what the cost of that would be. But also to teach them, you know, about the free market and free capitalism and things like that. And teach them, you know, what it was about those that made America, you know, the greatest country and the wealthiest country in the world. And it was honestly, it was kind of funny going through. So on the poll, we asked them, you know, can you define socialism? And, you know, that's where that majority came in, and they couldn't define it. But we gave them sort of open-ended questions where they could offer their ideas about what they thought socialism was. And so we got everything from free stuff to some people saying the ability to socialize in the world. And so, again, they don't understand how bad socialism is, because arguably they're just not being taught what it is. And so that's where, you know, we at Young America Foundation believe we have a really important gap to fill in providing opportunities for, you know, the discussion of these issues, because obviously they're just not happening as it is in education.
Right. Please tell me a majority did not think that socialism meant the ability to socialize. I don't want to believe that a majority of them actually believe that. That's crazy.
Yeah, well, it's really interesting to look at the other numbers that we found, including we did some polling about the classroom situation, because this was a poll of high school and college students. So we wanted to see, you know, how do these students feel when asked, you know, anonymously, what do they report feeling in the classroom? And we found that almost half of the people we polled said that they've stopped themselves from sharing their ideas or opinions in the classroom because they were worried that they would either be judged for their opinions or that their opinions would offend their classmates. And so in there, we see sort of, you know, the way the left has corrupted the educational process to be about feeling good and feeling happy, as opposed to actually discussing, you know, tough things, tough ideas, and being able to think critically. And so that was, I think, part of where, you know, you get to a point where 35% of young people think socialism is a good thing, because they're just not having the discussions about it in the classroom, where they might hear from, you know, a peer who maybe their parents emigrated here from, you know, a socialist country. They're just not having the opportunity to hear the truth about it.
Right. Well, that would seem to indicate, if, and I'm guessing here, but you can correct me, if you have a number of young people who don't want to share their opinions in the classroom because they don't want to offend anybody or they don't want to be judged, it would seem that would be more true if they had more conservative opinions, given the fact that I rarely meet a leftist who's unable or scared to share his or her opinion. They're pretty bold, but it's the conservatives, it seems, that tend to keep their mouths shut because they don't want to have trouble.
Well, right. That's exactly true. Because if you look at what happens to conservatives when they do speak freely in the classroom, you know, it's always been the case almost at colleges, but now even more so in high schools, where if a conservative speaks up, you know, they're targeted by their peers. Sometimes their teachers will scold them, or, you know, we have those situations where conservative students are forced to go to these mandatory sensitivity trainings because their teachers or their peers report them for committing a bias infraction. And it's a situation where conservatives, you know, really are just staying silent rather than having to face the consequences. And I think, interestingly, in the poll, we also asked about their personal ideology. And a third of the students reported identifying as moderate, which I think is a result of, you know, young people today not wanting to sort of out themselves as conservatives for fear of what the, you know, consequences of that might be, but are also unwilling to identify as leftist because, you know, if you say you're a leftist, then you have to buy into all this radical ideology that they're pushing these days. And so I think that's why we have, you know, a third of this next generation just trying to sit it out in the middle and, you know, not wanting to be, you know, forced to be a crazy leftist or targeted because they're a conservative.
Boy, that's interesting. It was very fascinating to me as well that you found that young Americans identified freedom and freedom of speech as the top two core American values. I mean, that's really encouraging. And yet these are some of the same students who are self-censoring when they're in the classroom. That's pretty ironic.
Well, yeah, exactly. It's interesting to see that they recognize that that's, you know, a core value of our country. But it does show, you know, that they're still reporting that they're not enjoying those freedoms that they think make the country great. And then obviously, you know, if they're identifying freedom as a core principle, but then finding socialism favorable, that again just points to the disconnect between what they think is good and what they know to be good. And again, opens up that door for us to come in. And, you know, we have our campus lecture program. We have our Young Americans for Freedom chapters across the country. And it's really those student activists who have the opportunity now to go into their classrooms and speak up and be bold advocates for our ideas. Because we did also find in the poll when the respondents were given sort of scenarios that portray the truth of socialism, their opinion on socialism did move to view it less favorably. And so it shows that, you know, this is not sort of baked in. This is not a lost generation by any means. They definitely still appreciate America and the good stuff about it. They just don't know necessarily why it's good and why it works.
Well, that's great. All the more reason to get in there and educate them. Did you have hard numbers, Spencer, on how many in this generation were very firm on the left that they said, I really identify with the hard left and I want to be a radical like I'm being radicalized maybe at school or on the internet?
Well, it was interesting to me because it broke down almost evenly into those thirds. So like I said, there was about a third that identified as moderate, and there was, it came out to 26% that they were very or somewhat conservative, and 23% said very or somewhat progressive, with that, you know, roughly a third then still saying that they're moderate. And interestingly, 15% were unsure. So again, it's just sort of this environment and this landscape where there really is an opportunity to reach these young people before their ideology is set, which usually happens, you know, during college, and make sure that they know the truth.
That's awesome. So when you talk about teaching this generation about the free market, how do you go about instructing them on how to think about economics and why the economy of the United States is the way it is, why it has thrived the way it has, as opposed to socialistic countries where you have centralized planning and you know, you look at the history of socialism, it's been a total train wreck. What do you emphasize when you go in and try to teach these students about socialism versus capitalism?
Well, one of the easiest ways is often overlooked, but just to ask them to take the cell phone out of their pocket and ask them where it came from. Because, you know, nobody has an iPhone or any sort of technology today that wasn't, you know, either dreamt up or created here in the United States. And then you can ask them, you know, why is that? Why is there this lively competition between Apple and Android? Why do you have all of this technology, all this power and all this information at your fingertips that you kind of take for granted here? That's something that didn't come about because of a socialist economy or a socialist system. And then from there, once you kind of get them thinking about like, okay, how did somebody come up with the idea and manufacture and design all of this, you realize that when the government's in charge of everything, you know, all you have to do is look at the Soviet Union or even Cuba. If you look, you know, if you took students on a field trip to Cuba, they'd look at all the old cars and think like, oh, this is kind of, you know, cool and old worldy. But they don't realize that it's because they haven't had any innovation there because of the horrors of totalitarian leadership there. And so it just sort of takes, you know, giving them these real world examples about what they have in their own pocket proves the beauty and how well the free market works. And then from there, you know, you can show them the reality of what it was like in the Soviet Union and in Cuba and to an extent in China. And then, you know, once they think about it, I think it's a little bit easier for them to comprehend what they have themselves.
That's great. What would you say is your biggest takeaway from all this data?
Well, I think, again, you know, it's that it's definitely not a lost cause. I know, you know, people like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and even Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren have been saying that socialism is the way of the future and young people have embraced it and we need to, you know, make our country work for young people. But clearly that's not the case. You know, while they may find the word socialism to be a good thing, they definitely don't like the effects of it, whether they realize it or not.
Yeah, well, let's hope you're right. I think it's going to be very encouraging to see if we can get more people in the upcoming generations to really embrace freedom and free markets. This is fantastic. And so glad for the work of the Young Americas Foundation. You can check out more at yaf.org. Spencer Brown with us. Thanks a lot, Spencer, for the update. This hour of Janet Mefford Today is brought to you by Affirm Films and the Kendrick Brothers movie Overcomer, starring Alex Kendrick and Priscilla Shirer. Rated PG, parental guidance suggested, in theaters now. More information is available at overcomermovie.com. We'll be right back on Janet Mefford Today. This Janet Meffer Today podcast is brought to you by Preborn. For $140, you can provide ultrasounds to five women in crisis pregnancies. Call now, 855-402-BABY. That's 855-402-2229 or janetmefford.com. Welcome back to Janet Meffer Today. Has the American experiment in ordered liberty run its course, or is there still hope that our nation can be healed and restored to its reliance upon Christian values? This is a really important question, and it's one that my next guest dives into in his new book. Tim Gegline is Vice President for External and Government Relations at Focus on the Family and author of the book American Restoration: How Faith, Family, and Personal Sacrifice Can Heal Our Nation. Tim, great to have you with us. How are you doing?
Janet, it's great to be with you and a real pleasure. Thank you.
Well, it's nice to have you here. You have been very involved, as many people will know, in public life and politics over the years. You worked for Senator Dan Coats and President George W. Bush. How would you say, from your vantage point, America has changed over the last several decades, especially when it comes to our moral and spiritual condition?
Well, I think that there is an almost tangible regression of spiritual strength in our public square. You know, Janet, there was a time, really not long ago, where it was considered bad manners in many quadrants in American life, in the public square, in law, in media, in medicine, in academia, in education, even in entertainment, where that spiritual quotient, which arises from the Judeo-Christian tradition in America, it was almost considered bad manners if that kind of patina was not there.
Right.
And yet, I think that overwhelmingly, Americans feel and they sense and they see and they experience this kind of regression that is deeply concerning to them. And if I may say, Janet, it's really in opposition to the best of the American tradition.
Well, it really is. We have come a long way since our founding, and you talk a lot in the book about our founding principles. But when you're talking about this tangible regression that you've noticed, do you think there was any particular tipping point that sent us over the ledge, or do you think this has just been a gradual regression and one domino has knocked into the next, so to speak?
Well, I love that question because I think you can actually date this lack of spiritual rigor in the very deepest DNAs in American life, really dating from the social and the moral revolution of the 1960s and 70s. And in fact, we are a very young country still. This question of where did this kind of tipping point happen? What was the inflection point? What was the, what was the hinge of it? It is remarkable, Janet, how many people have no memory or recollection in their own lives of this massive upheaval in American public life in the 1960s, 70s, and really in the 80s.
Yeah.
And if I may say, there are a number of people who are aware of it, who have a sense that maybe it ended at some point in the 90s, maybe in the early 2000s, but it's just the opposite. The reason that we titled our book American Restoration, How Faith, Family, and Personal Sacrifice Can Heal Our Nation is because it is all of these pillars, all of these foundations that in fact define America, and they are the thing we believe overwhelmingly that Americans want restored in the deepest recesses of American public life.
Right. And yet we have this huge battle going on in our culture right now. You have on the left such an incredible revolution that seems to have gained new strength in the last several years since President Trump came on board. It seems with some of these really radical abortion laws that we've seen and the really strong push for the LGBT agenda, the drag queens and everything else, there are a lot of Christians that are witnessing all of this and saying this thing has gained teeth just within the last 2 years to a point where a lot of Christians are really scared.
You know, I'm so glad you raised this, Janet. I am in my 11th year as one of the vice presidents at Focus on the Family, and I travel a lot. I travel about a third of the time. I live and work here in Washington, D.C., but I'm on the road in real America a lot. And no matter where I go, it can be a set of remarks, it can be a debate, it can be a forum, a panel, an interview. Overwhelmingly and almost with precision, I can predict that when we get to the dialogue, conversation, questions and answers part, of my remarks, people will raise their hand and they will say the following: I've never been more concerned about my country.
Yep.
If they have children and grandchildren, they will say, I'm deeply concerned about the country and culture that I'm leaving to them. And most importantly, Janet, they will say, I don't know what to do. And one day, after about the 9 millionth time of hearing this, I picked up the telephone and called the man who would become my co-author of American Restoration, Craig Osten. And I said, I believe we need to write a book that goes to the heart of the answer to all of these great people who are saying, what can we do? What needs to be restored? And what can I do in the place where God has placed me? And that is the narrative of American Restoration. It's not just an analysis of the cultural winds, which are very serious in our time, but it is also a very hopeful, proactive look at what real people in real situations can really do.
Well, that's great. And you can look at the big picture in terms of returning to our founding principles. And yet for a lot of Christians, the reaction will be, how do you put the lid back on Pandora's box? That seems to be a common question as well, doesn't it? It might be in your experience where people say, once you have unleashed this evil that we unleashed as a country with the sexual revolution and abortion on demand and everything else that we're seeing, short of a gigantic revival and the Lord coming down and visiting us once again as a church and bringing people to himself, what other hope is there for American restoration? Where would you tell people to begin in being the kinds of American citizens that will encourage America to be restored to its foundational principles and its Christian values?
I promise you, Janet, I have done numerous interviews on the book, and the question you just asked is the absolute narrative of American restoration. And let me just say, despair and discouragement in the Christian life is a sin, because despair and discouragement over the course of our country and culture negates the hope of Jesus Christ. And we know not only in world history or in the history of Western civilization, but we know even from American history that there have been the most difficult, the most divisive hinges of American history. And at those points in American history, you know, millions of men and women threw up their hands and they said, we're done. It's over.
Yep.
And yet we have had incredible periods in America of renewal. And I believe, and my co-author Craig Osten believes very strongly, that in fact renewal and restoration is not only possible, that it's probable. And in fact, we believe that there are practical ways that men and women of faith in our most, you know, local neighborhood, community, church, that there are places and things that we can do today that will help in very major ways to restore this country that we love so much.
Well, Tim, what would you say are the things that we most need to restore? Where would you begin?
Well, may I say, as one of the vice presidents at Focus on the Family, and I'm not overstating or understating this, if we are serious about regenerating, renewing, and restoring our country, it begins in our families, in our marriages, and in our parenting. It begins in our churches. It begins in our communities, and it begins in our neighborhoods. You know, Janet, a little while ago, you and I were talking about the 1960s. It's easy to forget that in the middle of the 1960s, the federal government took it upon itself to create what they called a great society.
Mm-hmm.
And they enforced on all 50 states this remaking of America. It's breathtaking in what it did. The great society was mostly not great when it came to marriage, family, and parenting, a lot of other things that we care about. What we say in American Restoration is there is not going to be an imposition of restoration from Hollywood, from the financial district of New York, from Washington, D.C., from Silicon Valley. Despite all of the promises, restoration begins at the most local level.
Yep.
It begins where God has placed us.
Well, Tim, let's pause. We're going to come back. Tim Gegline with us. American Restoration is the name of the book. You're listening to Janet Mefford Today. We'll come right back.
Hi, this is Mike Reagan, author, political commentator, and son of the 40th President of the United States, Ronald Reagan. And I enthusiastically support the life-saving work of Preborn. They work 24/7 in the highest abortion cities in America to care for moms in unplanned pregnancies. Would you go to preborn.org today and help save an innocent baby's life?
Saving a baby's life has never been as important as it is right now. With more and more states legalizing abortion up to 9 months, the Ministry of Preborn is the largest provider of free ultrasound sessions in the nation. Would you join with Preborn and Janet Mefford today to help save babies? For $140, you can sponsor 5 ultrasounds and help save 5 babies from abortion. All gifts are tax deductible, and when you donate, you'll receive a story and a picture of 5 babies whose lives were spared. To donate, call 855-402-BABY, 855-402-2229. That's 855-402-BABY, or there's a banner to click at janetmefford.com. Are you among the millions of Americans who feel uncertain when it comes to your health care? As a Christian, are you looking for health care that doesn't violate your morals and convictions? Well, we're happy to inform you that there is a solution, and that solution is Liberty HealthShare. Liberty HealthShare is a community of like-minded Christians who work together to pay for their medical costs. It allows you to decide how, when, and where you will access health care so you can make the best choice for you and your family. Starting at $199 a month for a single, up to $529 a month for a family. That's mom, dad, and all the kids. This is how health care should be. For more information, call 855-585-4237 or visit lightyourliberty.com. That's lightyourliberty.com, and regain control over your health care costs. 855-585-4237 or lightyourliberty.com. Together, we're changing health care for good. We are back on Janet Mefford Today talking about American Restoration, how faith, family, and personal sacrifice can heal our nation. Tim Gegline is joining us, and we are so grateful that he is here. He's Vice President for External and Government Relations at Focus on the Family and has spent many years in politics and public life, so he brings a lot to bear on this particular issue. You were making the point, Tim, before we went to the break about the Great Society that did not turn out to be such a great government program whatsoever when it came to the really helping the family and helping our faith grow and all of the things that really have been the bulwark of our country over the years. What about the principles, though? When you look back at the founders, you look at the founding principles. One of the things that you mentioned in the book is the fact that we've had in the West this civilization with two sources of authority, Christian values and rational enlightenment. But those two sources were able to coexist based on shared joint beliefs. So that has unraveled to some extent. What do we do about that? And how do we return to our founding principles and find common ground and go back to E Pluribus Unum? Is that even possible?
Well, I in fact believe it's not only possible, but I think it's probable. And I believe very strongly that America's best days are ahead. And I want to be very careful in saying this, Janet, because I do not believe that confetti, you know, to the wind optimism or talking points is what we're talking about here. Yes, I'm optimistic by nature, but I'm a hopefulist. I'm a Christian. And I believe very strongly that it is the muscular Christianity, which is a great part of our faith tradition in America, can be reapplied in the public square. And may I say, it begins with individual Christian men and women being bold enough to say, despite my own discouragement, despite my own discontent, I'm not going to opt out. I am going to reengage as never before. What does that mean? It means getting involved as never before. It means getting involved in orphan care, foster care, and adoption. It means getting personally involved in the pro-life cause. It means running for office, not just for federal office, not just from the U.S. Senate or, you know, the U.S. House of Representatives, although that's very important. But it's extremely important to run for the school board, run for city council, run for county council. I was giving a speech 2 weeks ago, speaking to about 3,000 people, and it was a place, you know, filled with fellow conservatives and Christians. And I asked, very simply, how many of them had contemplated running for public life, you know, just in the last couple of years, with all the concerns we have. And in that giant room and large numbers of people, not a single hand went up. And I asked back, why is that? And may I say, wave upon wave of it's really over, isn't it? Hmm. I mean, there's really nothing that we can effectively do, you know, in the public square to make a difference. And I said just the opposite. It's remarkable how many members of the U.S. Senate and their senior staffs, how many members of the House of Representatives and their senior staffs, how many people at the White House and in all of the 16 executive cabinet-level agencies, it's remarkable how many serious Christians there are in those quadrants. We have never needed Christians in our law and legal life, in our judicial realms, in education, in the gamut that makes up American public life and culture. Culture leads, and we have never needed people of a Christian worldview more than we need them now. But I think, Janet, back to where we started our interview, I think that there is a palpable sense that this cultural tsunami, this secular tsunami, has been so strong that, in fact, there's no way forward for our country. And I think very strongly that that's misapplied. I think, in fact, there are great ways to restore the Constitution, to restore biblical values to the public square, to restore civility and education and all these things that we hold so dear.
Well, that's interesting, because when you said that, it reminded me of those who say, well, you can't change politics until you change the culture. You know, you can't mandate or legislate goodness or virtue onto a population. It has to go in reverse. But in fact, why does it only have to be one way? We have seen, for example, as you mentioned before, Christians in the public square and President Trump actually doing things that Christians have been very happy with on the pro-life front. For example, he got in there and he's about as opposite of Obama as you can be on the life issue. And he just started doing things. And there you go. I mean, that is room for encouragement, isn't it? When we look at instances like that, you don't have to wait for the entire culture to become Christians in order to make a difference in our culture.
I'd like to give four major examples in American public life to the very point, Janet, that you just made. Point one, the American Revolution. It never would have happened. It never would have been successful without the deep and constant involvement of the American church.
Right.
Point two, the abolition of the slave trades. Never would have happened. Never would have happened. I'll say it again. Never would have happened without the involvement of the church, paraministry, and Christians in public life.
Yep.
Point three, the civil rights movement of the 1950s and 60s. Never would have happened without Christian sensibility and Christian churches and people being involved at every single level. Fourth example, the pro-life movement. It never would have happened. It never would have been successful. I mean, look where we're at today. A lot of people say, oh my gosh, these major cultural headwinds, they are so strong, you know, we cannot change the course of our country. That was not true in the American Revolution. It was not true in the abolition of the slave trades. It was not true in the major and minor turns of the civil rights movement, and it was certainly not true in the pro-life movement. Christian involvement matters, and as you say, culture first, public policy follows, but not one without the other.
That's good. And you mentioned running for the school board can be as significant as running for Congress. And I'm glad that you brought that up in particular, because one of the areas that concerns so many Christian parents, maybe more than anything else, is what is happening in the public school system and what we're seeing with the trans agenda, what we're seeing with bathroom policies, what we're seeing with all kinds of, you know, school shootings, you know, all the things that go on in the public schools, the radicals that they point out might be part of the teachers' unions. And they say, well, how do you fix that? Because that seems like an unfixable problem. The public school system seems to be gone. What about hope in the area of education and the difference that Christians can make there?
I love that question, and we devote an entire chapter in our book to restoring education, to restoring patriotism, to restoring citizenship. And may I say, this is perhaps more crucial than anything else. Young America is only half of our population, Janet, but young America is 100% of our future, and whoever wants this generation is going to get them. And may I say, those who are on the left, those who have a worldview in opposition to ours and different from ours, they are very serious about how they want to form the rising generation of young Americans. It poses the question, how serious are we about the same matters?
Right.
In American Restoration, in our book, we go to the heart of just how important it is in the formulation of young minds, young hearts, young souls. It's very important that we focus like a laser beam on the rising generation of Americans, because they will palpably be the leaders, the formers, the shapers, the impactors of the next generation of America. So American Restoration, our book, is really rooted to a large degree in looking not backward but forward with special attention on young America.
Well, and it seems to be a really important thing as we're sort of in the interim between the revolution of the 60s and a potentially restored America down the road, that we do have a lot of work to do, as you mentioned, Tim, in our churches, but also in our families, concentrating on our own children, our own grandchildren, making sure that they learn the Bible, that they learn Christian values at home. That's the heart of it. We can't just look at culture and expect culture to form our kids. We have to do that work ourselves. And that's never been more important, it would seem.
I could not agree more. And to not lose the biggest single point, if we are to restore America, it will begin with a spiritual restoration of the first order. The United States of America is not like England, it's not like Italy, it's not like Spain, it's not like Germany. We are a religious republic. And in the American experience, in the best of the American experience, we must never decouple the Judeo-Christian tradition from vigor and vitality in our most important public and cultural institutions.
Yes, Tim, that's
not Hollywood's country. It's not Washington's country. It's our country.
Yep.
And it begins with self-government.
Absolutely. Tim, we're running out of time, but we appreciate Tim Gegline. The book is called American Restoration. And Tim, so good to have you here. Thank you very, very much.
Such a joy. Thank you, Janet.
All right. God bless you. And thanks for being with us here on Janet Mefford Today. We'll see you next time.